The broadcast is now starting. All attendees are in listen-only mode.
Good afternoon. My name is Courtney Kendall from the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, and I'd like to welcome you to today's webinar. We're excited to have you with us today. We will allow people a few more minutes to call in and log on, so while we wait, I will go over some logistics, and then we'll get started with today's webinar. First, I want to mention that everyone is on listen-only mode, and this presentation will be recorded. You have two options for how you can hear today's webinar. In the upper right corner of your screen, there's a box that says audio mode. This will allow you to choose whether or not you want to listen to the webinar through your computer speakers or a telephone. As a rule, if you can listen to music on your computer, you should be able to hear the webinar. Select either use telephone or use mic and speakers. If you select use telephone, the box will display the telephone number and specific audio pin you should use to dial in. We will have a questions and answers session at the end of the presentation. You can participate by submitting your questions electronically during the webinar. Please do this by going to the questions pane in the box showing on your screen. There you can type in any question that you have during the course of the webinar, and our speakers will address as many questions as time allows. With that, I would like to welcome you to today's webinar titled Transmission Permitting and Interconnection Process. I want to thank each of you today for taking the time to join the fifth webinar in the Transmission Webinar Series that is being given in cooperation with the Bureau of Land Management and NREL. The BLM Washington office recognizes with declining budgets, travel restrictions, and heavy workloads that it's difficult to get away from your office to attend training. So BLM and NREL have developed this webinar series to inform as many federal agencies, staff, and managers as possible regarding electric transmission markets, electric grid overview, transmission planning, transmission permitting, as well as construction and maintenance activities. And as you can see from the map on your screen, the BLM is facing over 25 high-voltage transmission projects. These projects span 11 states and affect about 58 BLM field offices. Many of these transmission projects affect other federal agencies as well, such as U.S. Forest Service, Fish and Wildlife Service, National Park Service, and Bureau of Indian Affairs. So we have invited them to join us on these webinars as well. The Department of Interior Secretary Jewell and the BLM Principal Deputy Director Corns has placed a high priority on timely and effective transmission permitting projects. Now, with an aging electrical infrastructure and continued emphasis on expanded generation from renewable and natural gas, our transmission workload is expected to remain high. So it's important that our Bureau of Land Management managers and staff have a solid understanding of these transmission projects. We hope that you find this webinar series informative. We are going to record these webinars and make them available at a later date on the Knowledge Resource Center hosted by the BLM's National Training Center. So thank you again, and now I'll introduce today's speaker, Ed Weber. Ed is the Senior Technical Advisor with HDR Incorporated. Go ahead, Ed.
Thank you, Courtney. Good afternoon. I hope everyone can hear me okay. I'm going to try to keep my voice at a normal talking level so I don't feel like I have to shout. As Courtney said, my name is Ed Weber. I'm a senior technical advisor with HDR. I've been with HDR almost 5 years now. Prior to that, I worked for Western Area Power Administration here in the West, headquartered in Lakewood, Colorado, and I was a senior manager with them in the planning group. So my background has been really the development of a lot of these kinds of processes for interconnection. And so I've spent probably the last 20 years dealing with interconnection processes and or developers along the way. So with that, I've entitled this A Roadmap to Transmission Interconnection in the Western U.S., but it keep in mind that it is not the only map that's out there. There may be some other processes that folks are using, but this is something that I'm familiar with and is pretty standard throughout the industry in the Western U.S. right now. I say that only because the eastern part has a proliferation of independent system operators, ISOs. I'll talk a little bit about those there towards the end of the presentation, let you know what's going on in that arena. Next slide, Courtney. Oh, here's the one that I was telling you about. HDR is accredited to provide credits for this, so but we decided that wasn't probably going to work for this particular one. So moving along, next slide. Well, this is the learning objective. Next slide. Today's topics, I've pretty much given you an introduction. I'll talk a little bit more as we go. The first step will be talking about the various studies required, cost allocation models, a typical process followed by renewable energy developers, the use of eminent domain, permitting challenges and processes within the state and local areas, also tribal governments that we have to deal with. So, and then finally, a bit on the FERC Order 1000 and how that has really changed the planning process throughout the country at this point. And it's still under evolution, I should be clear on that, too. So next slide. This is where we're really going to start into the meat of the thing, where we're talking about the what is the utility required to do in the process that they have to use to facilitate renewable energy integration and interconnection. It is a very prescriptive process in that it is laid out very rule-oriented, if you will, step one, step two type of thing. And I'll talk through those. The procedures themselves are actually codified in the tariff of the transmission provider. Some of you may not be familiar with what a tariff is, and I'll talk a little bit about that here in the next few minutes. But basically, that is was established by FERC Order 888 and 889 back in the mid-90s, which the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission said, we're going to deregulate generation, but we're also going to make the usage of the transmission system much more open and available to the public. So the FERC orders basically established a process and a template, if you will, for the transmission service tariff and the open access transmission tariff that you commonly heard. So if you hear someone talking about an OAT and the LGIP, you're talking about the large generator interconnection procedures that are laid out in that individual transmission owner's tariff. Now keep in mind that as we talk about transmission providers, sometimes you'll find the acronym or you'll see it in literature known as PUTPROWs, P-U-T-P-R-O-W, and that is Public Utility Transmission Provider. And basically it is any company that owns transmission that has a tariff and was willing to sell that service. The hook there, of course, is that not every utility chooses to have all of its transmission into its tariff, and therefore they don't get cost recovery through the tariff process. But that's a bit of a longer story. One of the things about the tariffs is what they call pro forma, and that it is pretty consistent across the board between the different transmission providers. I show a link here, but before we go to the link, I want to talk just a little bit about the transmission service and how that is different than a transmission interconnection process. When we're talking about interconnection, we're talking about the physical connection of a generator to the grid. When we're referring to transmission service, we're referring to the delivery of the output of that generator, the megawatts and the kilowatt hours, if you will, across the transmission system to a group of customers or a single customer. And again, there are different kinds of transmission service depending on what your role is. If you are a load-serving entity, such as a cooperative or a municipal system, or even a traditional investor-owned utility, you will have network service to serve your captive load, if you will. And those are the customers that are directly connected to your system that you have a contractual obligation or, in some cases, a regulatory obligation to serve their total demand. So network service is a changing target, if you will. And the network service is you only pay for what you use over the given period of time. So the way the network service rate is calculated is you look at the total system demand of the transmission provider, and then you look at the individual load-serving entity's ratio of that total, And basically, it's if you're only using 10, if your total load is only 10% of the total that's on the transmission system, then you will pay 10% of the costs of the transmission system. And so it is a direct ratio of your load to the peak load on the system. Again, they call that the network service load and or the network ratio. The other kind is point-to-point transmission. And that is very, very different. Oftentimes, the generator is the person paying for the point-to-point service because they want to move their energy across the grid completely, okay? So when you're doing a transmission service request, which, again, is separate from an interconnection process, when you're doing a transmission service request, you have to specify, am I asking for network service or am I asking for point-to-point service? Point-to-point service is take or pay, which means that you will pay for reserving transmission capacity on the grid 24 hours a day, 7 days of the week. So whether you're moving megawatts and scheduling megawatts or not doesn't matter. You're still paying that point-to-point tariff. For renewable projects, that is very onerous because they cannot guarantee that they're going to use that transmission that they reserved over the 24-hour period. So there's often an extra burden of cost, if you will, because the renewables can be very unpredictable. I just wanted to bring that issue out because we're not going to talk necessarily a lot about the transmission service aspect of it, but we're going to talk about the interconnection process and how that process works and the permitting that's required with that. Keep in mind that the transmission service request can be made through the OASIS, which is the Open Access Same Time Information Service. And you're generally going to be allowed to make that request on or about the same point in time when you make your interconnection request. But I'll talk a little bit more about that here in a few minutes, too. It may be better for a project to do the interconnection studies and determine what the facilities are going to be required before they make the transmission service request, because once you've made that request, then you move into another phase of studies that can be quite lengthy and quite expensive. So at this point, Courtney, let's go to this hot link, and I'll show you the general process of how you'd want to interconnect to any given utility in the West. So what we're looking at here is the West Trans transmission service company, if you will. And I'm going to pick on Nevada Power there just because they are one that I have done some work for here in the past, and it's kind of central to our whole area out here. So if she clicks on that, you'll see Nevada Power, and then you see you click to go to the OASIS, okay? That's the same Open Access Same Time Information System. Now, on the left, you see these drop-down menus. And if we move over to Transmission and Interconnection Requests, near the bottom there, a little more, further down. There you go. Now, just sit there for a minute. If you notice, can you move over a little bit? Yeah. There's pre-application queues. There's the interconnection requests. There's the NVE TSR. TSR stands for Transmission Service Request. Okay, so and you will see that has been consolidated into the balancing area and balancing authority. So not going to talk too much about that, but why don't you go ahead and click on the interconnection request there.
It's taking 1 minute to load, so.
Yes, it's not unexpected, so. But while that is loading, you might also notice here that on the left, there's the tariff, the changes to the tariff. Again, we're talking open access transmission tariff here. You'll see that there's applications and agreements, network customers. Again, I referred to the folks who would be the load serving entities would be the network customers. So. Doesn't look like that necessarily is going to pop open, does it?
No, it doesn't. I've clicked it a few times. Let me try to.
You know, that I would say let's.
Oh, rather than there we go.
Oh, look at that. Okay. So if you, and I don't know how well the audience can see that, but if you look through these interconnection requests, you know, we're seeing on the just a couple of things, the relative size of them. One of the things that if the generation project is smaller than 20 megawatts, again, 20 is a threshold, then it will be considered a small generator. And that interconnection process is expedited. You don't necessarily have to go through all of the necessary studies that you would for a large generator. Okay. A large generator, you're going to do a feasibility study at the outset. With a smaller generator, oftentimes the utility folks will get together with the application, you know, the interconnection customer, and say, we know by inspection that where you're proposing to connect is not is going to be feasible, just because we know our system and we know the size of your thing, your project. So we'll just skip over the feasibility and go right into the system impact study. Again, if you notice these locations, they don't tell you what they don't tell you, who is the developer. They won't give you any company names. They will give you the county that it's in. They won't even tell you the exact interconnection location. A lot of that is considered business private, if you will, or confidential business information. So they try to respect the fact that it is a very competitive industry out there right now. Again, if you look at the projected in-service dates there, some of these have already passed. Again, it may be that the facility study is now underway and that they have come to agreement, and now the facilities are under construction. This won't change until you have seen, until the project is actually energized, and then it will be taken off this list. Again, if you look on the right-hand side, the far column there, it's pretty obvious there's only one gas project, and that was submitted in 2008, and it was a 150-megawatt gas plant. And that's all we really know. It's in Clark County, which is near Las Vegas. So, okay, let's go back to the main slide here. Yeah, the reason I showed this is just to let the audience know that there is a lot of information that can be gathered out there on these projects that is public information. And this was just an example I picked on Nevada Power. Virtually any of the links that we saw on this map would have very similar information, and that is they will have an interconnection application process. And in some cases, they have their own form that they want you to fill out. But interestingly, all of the critical information on that form has to be consistent with what the FERC orders have said. So the FERC Commission has got their fingers in this application process all the way down to exactly what information you can request or should be requesting from the renewable developer. I'll talk a bit more about the FERC Order 1000, but there are other FERC orders that are requiring utilities to document that, yeah, my tariff is up to date. And again, those are what we call tariff filings, and they're fairly frequent as things change and as FERC changes their rulings on how the interconnection process should play out. Why don't we go to the next slide? Okay, so here is just a general process overview, and I'm going to assume that it is going to be a large, so that we'll talk a bit about the feasibility study. Again, as I mentioned, you must submit a written application, and that application will typically have a fee between $5,000 and $10,000. I think a large generator interconnection fee now, in some utilities, they are asking for $25,000 or as much as $50,000 even to begin the study process. And this money is refundable during various periods of the off-ramp. The feasibility study, if you will, is the very first step. And the feasibility basically is the initial look at the interconnection point, The utility will look at the facilities in the neighborhood and say, okay, I've got a 345 kV line, I've got a 230, I've got a 115. When you make application as a developer, you have to tell them what part of the system you want to connect to. Do you want to connect to the 115 kV system? Or do you want to connect to the high voltage system of the 345 or 500? Now keep in mind that your costs are going to be less to connect to the lower voltage system because you won't have these expensive high voltage facilities to purchase. On the other hand, you may have, on the low voltage system, you may not have enough available transmission to deliver your load or deliver your generation to the load. So it's kind of a catch-22. So it's not uncommon to see a project start out on the high voltage system until they do the feasibility study and see what the costs may be. And then they do give you an opportunity to reduce the size of the project. They do not, in the tariff process, give you an opportunity to change the interconnection location. Now, location is always, that's open to legal interpretation, but suppose you have 500, 230, and 115 all in the same substation at the same location. You can request that the utility evaluate both the 115 and or the 230 kV levels. You typically cannot ask for more than two interconnection voltage levels, okay? And in some cases, it's really not worth the extra money to have them do the evaluation because these studies are conducted on a time and material basis. They're actual costs. They're not lump sums. So you don't give them $50,000 and then they come back with a two-page study. They're typically very rigorous studies that are done looking at the facility capacities and or the power flows, the contractual arrangements that are there in the place. For example, you try to come into a large substation like the El Dorado Valley substation there in South Las Vegas. You know, there's four different owners in there of facilities that you're going to have to talk to. And so you have to be very cognizant of who you're dealing with in terms of interconnection. I did mention there's an off-ramp there. If the utility comes back and say, you know, it's really not feasible for me to connect your project at this location to the existing facilities because they're just too small or your project is too large, they will give you an opportunity to reduce your project, but by no more than 30%, okay? So the reduction can only be as much as 30% of the total. So if you've asked for 100 megawatts and they come back and say it's not feasible, you can say, well, is 70 feasible? One of the things that the feasibility study will do, and if the utility is, and typically the utilities will do this, they'll tell you how much they can feed onto that existing system, which is a good thing. On the other hand, if you say, well, the economics of my project, it almost has to be 100 megawatts or I really can't make it to pencil out, then you're allowed to basically walk away and any unused money that was done to do the facility study will be refunded to you. Okay, and the same holds true with all of those up to the point of the facility study, and I'll talk about that. So once you've got a feasible project, okay, then here's where the system impact study comes in. And again, a feasibility study might be nothing more than a desktop analysis of existing facilities in the area. A system impact study actually will involve three different kinds of analysis. You'll do a steady state power flow analysis. You'll do a short circuit fault analysis to determine the breaker ratings and or equipment ratings. And then you'll oftentimes be required to do a transient stability analysis of the generator as it operates on the system. So those three different components are pretty important because any one can be a showstopper depending on what part of the country you're in. For example, here in Montana and in the Midwest, we are often transient stability limited by the system rather than the steady state or the fault current limits on the system. So it's something that you have to work with or what the developers have to kind of be aware of. And that's honestly where me as a consultant comes into the picture, is I can help guide them,
you know, where they're going to probably be running into some problems. Again, if the system impact study, and one of the things that you'll find the system impact study will do also, it will identify facilities that are away from the interconnection point. So, for example, you know, if you're interconnecting a large wind project in California or even in Nevada on the One Nevada line, you may not have any problem getting the interconnection, but you may have limiting facilities somewhere else on the system that will require you to make some upgrades. It's not uncommon, for example, to find out you have to replace breakers and transformers remote from your interconnection point just because of the heavy loading and the additional generation that your project is adding to the system. So again, you've got an off-ramp there. If the facilities are going to cost you $40 million and that you just can't afford it, then you can walk away. Again, any unused dollars from the system impact study would be refunded to you. The next study now is the facility study, and that's where you've gone through the feasibility, the system impact, you've identified then the facilities that needed to be or that needed to be mitigated. The facility study now is where you actually start putting a dollar amount to those facilities. You start sizing them. You start doing a bit of preliminary engineering to determine, okay, what's my substation going to look like? Most often, utilities have pretty set criteria for their interconnection designs, and that is, if it's a generator large enough of a certain size, you're going to require real-time communication and monitoring and control of that generator by the host utility so that they can basically start and stop the generation under emergency conditions under a certain set of controls. Again, that comes in the interconnection agreement that is following the facility study. So the facility study will identify, okay, I need breakers, I need a transformer, I need some switches, and this may or may not be a brand new green site. The facilities may be added to an existing facility. In some cases, if there isn't room to add a single point of interconnection, there may be some substantial substation modifications that need to be made. So there a lot comes out of that facility study, but that is the best good faith estimate of the timeline that it will take you to construct the facilities to make the interconnection and to deliver the energy. And again, there's an off-ramp there. If those facilities are going to cost you way more than the project is worth, or the payback is longer than 5 to 7 years, most developers will walk away. And that's truly been the issue at this point with a lot of the projects in the West, is that these facilities that need to be added to integrate them into the grid are becoming more and more plentiful, and they're becoming more expensive as we go along. So, and here now is where I'm going to have to change tracks just a little bit to talk about the environmental process. But in fact, in reality, this environmental process can be done to a certain extent in parallel with some of these interconnection studies. So the bullet says, now we begin the environmental process. Yes and no. You can begin almost at the feasibility level study by looking at what general location you're going to be in, how far your project is from the existing grid. So will there be a connecting transmission line, for example, which is not uncommon to have a 20-mile line being required to deliver the renewable energy into the grid, because, frankly, that's where the wind blows and the sun shines. There's a lot of places where there aren't a lot of people and there aren't a lot of transmission facilities to deal with. So, and similarly now, when we begin the environmental process and begin land acquisition for the projects, oftentimes the developers will just hold an option for the land, and of course they have a certain period of time where they have to develop their project or they lose that option. But the interconnection process has to show proof of ownership for the application to be, and that's one of those legal terms that is merely an option to buy, proof of ownership. It has been shown that, yes, that is the case. However, if it turns out that the option cannot be exercised for whatever reason, then the study actually, they fall out of this interconnection process queue. So the company that I was with, Western Area Power, the federal agency, would not accept just an option. They said, no, we want you to actually show title. We want you to show that, yeah, you own the land or you have a lease agreement. And in most cases, it is a lease agreement rather than ownership, particularly if we're talking about a large wind farm, because that can be spread out over many hundreds of acres. And so it is actually a lease agreement rather than ownership. Those are acceptable. But again, those are the kinds of requirements that are needed before the application is even accepted, is you've got to be able to show, yeah, I own the project land, or I have a lease agreement where I can actually develop the project. Otherwise, it's a waste of all our time. You know, if you go down the road and do all these studies, it may take months to do. We don't want to go there. So similarly, and that's why I threw in the land acquisition, is if you're waiting until the end of the feasibility study to do the land acquisition, you probably are too late. So next slide, Courtney. That might be a good place to stop if there are any questions at this point. I guess I don't see anything, any hands up on the code there or anything. But are we everybody with me so far?
Okay. It looks like it, Ed.
Okay. I'm about halfway through here, a little more. I've got some more slides. But so let's go back to the application here. What are you going to require? Well, a single line diagram of your project. And that you don't necessarily have to have every wind turbine or every solar module depicted. But you have to show, am I going to have multiple feeders, for example? A 200 megawatt wind farm would typically, you don't want to design your feeders to have more than about 20 to 25 megawatts, roughly 10 to 15 to 20% of your project tied up on more than one feeder. And that's purely for reliability. You know, if you have a fault on one of your feeders, you don't want to lose the whole project. You want to be able to just take portions of it out and fix it and then go back to normal operation. So single line diagram, kind of laying out what the facilities are. And again, electrical engineer can help you with that. A geographic map showing, okay, the general geography of it. You know, are you covering two counties? Are you straddling tribal grounds or Indian reservation lands? Are you on federal and private both? Again, you have to lay out very clearly the geography of your project as part of the application. The list of proposed facilities, you can see on your screen there, the generator itself. Are there going to be other facilities required? Again, these are things that you as a developer and your consultant have identified as preliminary equipment that you're proposing to the utility to add as part of this project. Now, of course, the utility will come back and say, well, I don't like your design or your proposal. I'm going to need additional equipment. And that comes out in the negotiation and the discussion of the feasibility study and even into the facility study. So description of route size, when we're talking about routes, that goes back to, are you going to have a transmission line that's going to be required to deliver that to the grid some distance away? I know here in Montana, if it's less than 10 miles, it's considered part of the project. But if it's larger than that, then a 10-mile line is basically a standalone transmission line, and that has to be permitted separately from the generator itself. So it kind of depends on the locale that you're in. And I've got a couple of process slides for Oregon and Washington, and I don't know why I picked on them, because they're the most complicated ones I could find, I think. So, but again, these kinds of discussions are ongoing. It's not just a black box, if you will, where the developer makes an application and doesn't hear anything. Oftentimes, the utility will circle back two or three times for clarifying information and or just status reports. They have to have meetings as part of these studies go along. Transmission service arrangements. When you get to the interconnection agreement process, and that's basically a contract binding you to construct the facilities for the interconnection, you should have transmission service arrangements in place by that time. So you should, in parallel with your facility study, be looking at how am I going to deliver this energy across the system. So who's my transmission service provider? It may be the host utility, but then again, if you're coming in at a lower voltage, they may not be the transmission provider that you'll have to talk to, and that's not uncommon in the cooperative world out here in Wyoming and Montana and the Dakotas, that you would tie in at the 69 kV level, and that 69 line then is tied into the grid that may be example would be a member co-op of Tri-State. Well, Tri-State is the transmission provider out of Thornton, Colorado, but they may not be the utility or the co-op that you're initially interconnecting to. So you have to, again, keep in mind that this transmission service and interconnection processes are two separate processes. So that PPA stands for Power Purchase Agreement. Do you have a buyer for the energy? If you do, then that is really the key to a successful project, because a lot of projects will get into well into the facility study and they really don't have a buyer yet. And part of the reason being is you don't know what your end costs are going to be until you've gotten far enough into the facility study to know what your total transmission costs are going to be. Okay, so. And even additionally, the transmission service deliverability study may identify some additional costs that may have to be incurred. So we talked about one of the key issues was cost allocation of models. And here's where I'm going to just talk a minute about cost allocation. Traditionally, the utilities would require the developer to put up much of the money up front. When I say much of it, as much as 75 to 80%. Now, where that other 20% comes in, the host utility may recognize it may be to their benefit to have these facilities added, even though it is a generator owned by a third party, so they may be willing to take on some of those costs. Again, communication and control, breakers, a larger transformer may be required that may be useful to the utility. So a lot of these facilities can almost be negotiated to the mutual benefit of the utility. In some cases, the utility will say, well, in that particular location, these facilities are absolutely no use to me whatsoever, probably won't be for the next 10 years, so I'm gonna stand back and let you stand the entire cost. So there's a cost allocation model there that says those facilities are either on the back of the developer or on the back of the utility or both. It's rare that you will find interconnection facilities that would be covered by the ISOs or the RTOs. And I'll talk a little bit more about that on FERC Order 1000 when we start talking about transmission service and or cost allocation at the end of the day. So why don't we go to the next slide here, because I don't want to run out of time and I want to leave lots of time for questions. So here we go, process timeline. I get an application in June of 2013. I basically, as a utility provider, I have 2 weeks to contact them and arrange a scoping meeting, and that is just a phone call saying, got your application, everything looks good. Now, if there was something missing in the application, this would be the point where you would notify them your application is insufficient, I need additional information. Maybe the one-line diagram didn't have enough information, you know, that kind of thing. So then you send them within a couple of weeks a feasibility study agreement, and this is a contract, and they have, again, you have 15 days from the time of receipt of the application to offer them this agreement. And they have basically 30 days to send it back with a check for whatever the feasibility study fee might be. And I'm going to, typically for a large generator, it's going to be around $10,000, basically. So then the ball's back in the utilities court. And again, the utility can choose to do this study themselves, or they can farm it out to a third-party consultant, such as HDR or ABB or Siemens or Transerv, and there's a whole bunch of consulting firms out there that do these kinds of feasibility studies for developers. it's not uncommon for a developer to contact a consultant before they even make the application to the utility and say, you know, I'm thinking about doing a project here in central Wyoming. Can you give me a little background? I'll pay you a few hundred dollars before they make application to do what we call a pre-feasibility study. And that really is very much just look at the existing system. Is there anything that, looks like a showstopper on the initial pass? If not, then go ahead and make the application. And I do a ton of those just based on my knowledge of the system here in the West. So 60 days. So if you look at this whole thing, you're looking at about 90 days. Now, the reason I put an asterisk there is initially, depending on how the complexity of the project and the location within the grid, that may have to be extended, plain and simple, because this project will affect other queued projects. And I guess a good example would be all of the projects that are in the California ISO queue right now for renewables to tie on to the Tehachapi Renewable Transmission Project, okay? They've probably got several hundred applications that have to be studied in concert, if you will, or together to make sure that all of the impacts are being identified. So that is an asterisk. Ideal situation, you should have it back in 60 days. If it's in the middle of a whole bunch of other applications in a tough part of the grid, then it's probably going to be closer to 120 days. So we're talking 4 months. In some cases, it may be 6 to 8 months just for the initial study. System impact study, very similar situation. Again, depending on the complexity of it, it may take 60 days, may go a little longer. Facility studies, exactly the same. Now, here's where, and I threw that connected action in, here's where the study process would circle back, and you may have to modify your application because of environmental issues, and or you may have a federal nexus which will automatically require you to conduct an EIS, okay? So that connected action is an important thing to consider as a developer and as you're looking through this permitting process. And no offense to the audience, but because I worked for the feds for 30 years, but once we start getting into the federal actions and the federal process, it tends to slow down a bit just because of the timelines required for federal review and federal approval. And it's just the life we live. Now, I heard Courtney say that at the beginning, one of the reasons we're having this seminar is for you folks to look and try to identify ways that we can speed up this process. So. And I'm telling developers that come to me, we need to make sure that we identify all of our stakeholders early on, even in the feasibility level study. Developers are very paranoid about sharing their information early on because there's so many dollars that are on the table. So we'll find that they're kind of reluctant to tell everybody what their project is. And in some respects, I can understand why, because almost immediately you'll find a lot of opposition will be organizing and gathering for a particular project, regardless of what it is. There's going to be someone out there that's not going to like it. And so by not announcing your project, you're keeping the opposition at bay, but at the same token, you're probably slowing down your overall timeline for your project. So, okay, next slide. Okay, so, and again, the timeline I'm talking about here is probably the environmental review process. So, again, the initial review, general area, we can do a desktop analysis. Are you planning on putting your wind farm out in sagebrush habitat, your sagebrush grouse habitat? If the answer is yes, then you may want to consider it what you're going to be going through. Again, environmental study, we try to do this in parallel because we recognize there is a lot of the environmental groundwork that can be done for a project before the actual facilities have been finalized. And so that's what I'm trying to show here is that you offer someone a contract for an environmental study. And again, it would be a preliminary review. In most cases, the utilities will offer a consultant or will offer to do the work themselves through a third-party consultant, okay? And that's, again, something that HDR does. There's a lot of consultants out there, Terracon, to name a few, SAIC. There's probably a gazillion environmental firms that will do an EIS or a project review. Again, depending on what you're looking for, you're looking for a categorical exclusion, an environmental assessment, or an EIS. Again, that process, the most optimistic would probably be a CX, and that would probably be 6 months. EIS, you know, that's 24 months or longer if it ends up being challenged in court. So interconnection agreement, again, that is offered right after the facility study. And the reason that you do that is the facility study and this agreement will formalize exactly what is going to get built. And that's important when you're talking about an EIS, because that really is, okay, these are the facilities that are required from a transmission perspective, and here's the impact. So you've actually got the whole picture now in front of you, rather than when you're trying to do the environmental review before you actually know what facilities are required. So one of the things that in that interconnection agreement, I think I touched on that, is who pays for what facilities. The long lead time of some equipment for transformers, for example, utilities will often offer to buy a transformer for the developer at their cost, because utilities are in the transformer business. A lot of developers are not. On the other hand, international developers, Abengoa, Iberdrola, you know, some of the very large wind and or solar developers, they have a direct pipeline to vendors, and they can oftentimes get the equipment cheaper than the utility can. If the utility hasn't bought a transformer in the last 2 years, the developer probably has a better pipeline to get his foot in the door to get that equipment on a quicker timeline. Again, transformers right now, 22 months for delivery for a high voltage transformer, and that's quite lengthy. We've seen them as short as a year. Depends on how full the pipeline is and the demand of equipment. So, design and construction alternatives. Again, if you're starting with a greenfield site, depending on the location and the availability of contractors, that can go as long as 2 years to get it built. Depending on the complexity, again, I'm trying to use some general terms here, but it can be as long as 24 months. The average time for a development of a renewable project in HDR's experience, and we've done a lot of these in the last 10 years, is roughly 3 years from start to finish, from when you make the application to when you pull the switch and turn everything on and you're up and running and considered commercial. Average time is about 3 years. So. And that's, again, fairly optimistic. If you look at the different, facility studies, environmental, 9 months for environmental review, that kind of thing. Construction, 18 months, that includes a long lead time of equipment. So, we've got, again, that's an average. Some can go quicker. Some can go much longer, too. It just depends on where you're at and what you're dealing with. So, next slide. Okay, this is the basic environmental reviews, if you will. And these are costs that are fairly typical. Again, when you offer someone an environmental contract for environmental review, I know Western Area Power right out of the block asks for $50,000 to do, even if it's going to be a CX. This money is refundable, again, if not all of it is used. If you pull the plug on it halfway through the project, you'll find that there's, they might have expended half of the money, who knows. So, again, these are fairly typical costs. The last one there for environmental impact, $500,000, I think, would be pretty optimistic. I've heard some stories where, depending on if you're dealing with tribal agencies and others, can get more expensive because of the archaeological and the cultural resource aspect of it. So, again, $500,000 might be a good average number, but it's by no means the high end either. one of the things there, that last one, is the lead federal agency gets to be interesting during this environmental process is who are the lead agencies? Well, I think Courtney mentioned just the audience today, the BLM, that's the Interior, but even within Interior, you've got Forest Service, Fish and Wildlife, BIA, in addition to BLM. So, there's, depending on the agency that you're dealing with, you may have slightly different procedures and timelines for approval getting agency buy-off on them. I know that was particularly true with the Department of Energy. So why don't we go to the next slide? I think the next one actually talks a bit more about that. So, oh, just go back for one quick thing here. The go back one slide, I'm sorry. I just wanted, this particular transmission line on the right here, and I chose it for a picture. It's the Intermountain DC project, and you'll notice there's only two conductors hanging on the towers here. So for any of you in the audience who are looking at that thing, well, that's a funny-looking transmission line. You're right. It's a DC transmission line, direct current transmission line. It's an Intermountain project that runs through Nevada and Utah. So anyway, next slide. These are the different kinds of permits, and again, I'm being an electrical, I know enough about the permitting process to be slightly more than dangerous, but these are just the kinds of things that I, as an engineer, I'm aware of that I have to make sure that these boxes are checked, depending on where the process is at. So, again, next slide, you'll see there's even more. I couldn't fit it all on one on one page. A lot of the things that we're looking at here may only be required during the construction process. For example, a lot of the wastewater dust abatement, when I say wastewater, runoff water of your pad sites, for example, until the ground can be reclaimed and grass is planted in the natural habitat, around a wind farm or in a solar field, you're going to have to deal with the water issues. And that's been particularly onerous in some locations just because of the amount of rain we've had here lately, So, again, these are a list of some, maybe not all, but I think this is a pretty comprehensive list of what would be required. Next slide. Hopefully you folks have seen this since I flagrantly plagiarized it from a BLM website, but it looks like this is the basic process, if you will. And you notice the documentation of information needs. A lot of that would come from the study work that was done to identify the facility. So you could almost say this would be the spot where the applicant would insert their facility study and or the description of the facilities that are needed, why they're doing what they're doing, if you will. The plan of development, you want to make sure that you're working with the federal agencies, not just the BLM there, for that timeline, because you may have equipment and contractors scheduled to be delivered at a certain window in the spring, but that doesn't match with the permitting approval process through any one of several federal agencies. So that's another reason why developers are often get frustrated. They say, well, I went ahead and ordered my wind turbines and they're going to be delivered in April of 2014, and here I can't even get my approval to start construction till August of 2014. Well, duh, don't order your turbines yet, Again, those are lessons learned of projects that I've worked on for the last 10 years, and it's not uncommon for someone to have a stockpile of turbines that they have to take delivery on in a certain period of time. So, next slide. This is the Oregon, if you read, it's the Oregon Energy Facility Siting Council. And they have basically the requirements for permitting for NEPA review for anything greater than 35 megawatts, okay? And I think, honestly, a smaller, I think it falls under the radar, and those can be permitted at the local level rather than through the state level. But again, if you look at, they have a very similar requirements, if you will, as a federal process would. Again, that middle box there, typical timeline is 12 to 18 months. There's really no way to get around these permitting requirements. They will have public hearings in the different locations or in a single location where the project is located, trying to bring all stakeholders to the table. So, and the very last bullet there is, where the last two, the contested case hearing, if you will, and then the final order. There have been projects that have been disapproved, if you will. And in most cases, they can apply for arbitration, and they almost have to do that before they can go to court. And that's written into a lot of these state laws that they're, if you disagree with the state permit or lack of a permit, what are your final options? Well, you can submit to arbitration or you can actually go to court, and that's probably the most expensive and the least productive process. But you try to work through that in your public hearing process to gain that certificate. That's really what you want, is you need that certificate from the state before you can continue. So, next slide. Now, this is the Washington state, and this one is a little bit different in that you can see there are some parallel paths there, if you will, that can be taken. Again, this is the state energy facility siting process, and it is voluntary for wind projects, but our experience has been with HDR that the wind guys, the developers, want to go through this process anyway just to make sure that they cannot necessarily be challenged by a lawsuit at the end of the day because they didn't follow this environmental process, okay? And unfortunately, that's kind of where we're at in a lot of these projects right now, is the last hope for the local opponents of a project is to take them to court and sue and say their environmental process was not proper or robust. Again, having worked both sides of the fence, there's I say this in all honesty, anytime you get the attorneys involved, you're really going to spend a lot of money, and it's going to take a lot more time than if you try to negotiate it on more of a local level or a technical level rather than through a legal level, if you will. So, again, you notice that in each one of these, the bottom line is someone is going to make a decision, and it's what we call a record of decision. It's a very similar process that the feds would use through an environmental process, too. But you all want to hope that you can get this a positive governor's decision or record decision at the end of the day. And again, their timeline is very similar from the time the application comes in. You've got roughly 12 to 14 months, depending on the controversial nature of the project, if any. It may go quicker than that. It may go longer than that, too. So next slide. So, well, here's just a quick list of the federal agencies. And again, I've had the not so positive experience of working with the Department of State on two transmission lines that were actually connected actions. The Keystone Pipeline is a project that comes right through our service territory here in Montana and Dakotas, and HDR has done a lot of the electrical design work for that, and we've had to work through the environmental process with the Department of State because they decided, because the president, and who knows, the presidential permit is required for all facilities that cross international borders. And again, for those of you in the West who recognize, the Keystone Pipeline has been very controversial, and really what's holding up construction right now at this moment is the lack of a presidential permit. Everything else has been approved at the state level, and now we're just waiting on President Obama to sign this document before construction can begin. But the environmental process that the state used was slightly different than the Department of Energy used, which was slightly different than what the Department of Interior used. So there were some additional requirements by state that was not required by DOE or Interior. And I am remiss in that I should have gone back and looked at some of my documentation to figure out what exactly those requirements are, but I want to say it was collaboration perhaps with the Canadian government or provincial government at the outset that was not done appropriately, or it had to do with more the political aspect of it than the traditional technical aspects of the border crossing. So, and again, the Department of Army, the reason we're dealing with that is the Corps of Engineers is responsible for all water crossings and in a lot of cases navigable rivers out here. It's kind of tongue-in-cheek that, yeah, it's navigable for about 6 months out of the year, and then it dries up. Well, we have had to deal with, and COE is quite good to work with, actually, here in the West, I have to say that. So, next slide. We're getting close, and we're right on an hour here, so I will continue. I've got just a couple more slides. I don't want to miss any time on the FERC Order 1000 because that's kind of where we can tie a lot of these things together. State agencies involved, again, here in Montana, we call it the Department of Environmental Quality. Every state has some agency that has jurisdiction over this permitting. Again, public service commissions in a lot of cases are the deciding group for the permits. In Montana, we have significant state lands, so we do have an Office of State Lands. It's also required to be involved if state lands are going to be involved with the project or even touched by a part of the project. Again, stakeholder groups, public involvement. Most states now require public hearings, and just as a matter of course. And the current process has actually been, rather than a public hearing with written testimony and verbal testimony, the public meetings have often been open houses where they will have experts there to talk, provide information, provide a mechanism for comments and feedback. For example, when HDR conducts public hearings for transmission lines, we will have someone there taking notes. If someone wants to give a verbal statement, we'll have a gal that will write it. They will, type it into a computer. They will look at it, say, yeah, that's what I want to comment on this. And so it's worked out very well now in this electronic age to be able to do that. FERC Order 1000, the public involvement, and I think the next slide is FERC Order 1000, so why don't we jump there? Right. And I think this is probably one of the last slides that we have here, but the FERC Order 1000, which has just been ratified and the public utilities were required to submit a filing to document their planning process for large facilities in their footprint. And these planning groups can be quite large in footprint. In the West here, we have several well-known ones. West Connect is one of them, and the subgroup of West Connect is the West Trans website that you looked at. There's the Northern Tier Transmission Group, NTTG. There's the Columbia Grid. There's the California ISO, which is its own planning group, if you will. But there's four major principles of the FERC Order 1000 that are important for folks like us, myself, and you as the audience, and that is, the transmission providers must participate in a open and transparent stakeholder process, and they are required under the tariff filings that they have made to FERC to meet as a minimum four times a year, which is quarterly, and go through what the current status of the plan is for the development of transmission. So, for example, here we're closing in on the second quarter of 2013. These groups will be scheduling stakeholder meetings throughout the next month or 6 weeks to go over what the current transmission plan is for their area. And that might be, okay, I've got a generator project, I've got three transmission projects, and I've got a substation addition that I'm making. What is the current status of all of those projects? And they will tell you, well, the generator is still working through the system impact study. The transmission line now is being designed. They have gotten their permit. We're just, and so this is the update, if you will, for the stakeholders to say, the projects are moving ahead, or if the project's been canceled, it's taken off the books and saying, okay, as a transmission provider, I've decided to defer the addition of this transformer or this line. This process is open to everyone, and I mean that honestly, is you can go to one of these websites, again, NTTG, you can find all of these through the WEC website, WECC.biz, because they will talk about planning and they will have these websites available to you. It's been my comment here lately that if you're not involved in the planning process, you're really not trying very hard, if you're interested, okay? Because there is an opportunity out there that has just been opened the door. And again, I can say this as a utility guy for 30-some years. Back in the 90s, it was an old boys club. You know, we might have two or three utility planners sitting around a room, and we'd figure out what we needed for the next 10 years. And there really wasn't a lot of input from other groups to decide where is the best spot to put transmission or substations or generation projects. So the second element then is, again, I referenced the Tehachapi project. They got a lot of stuff going on right now. There is what they call the non-incumbent provider requirements, and that is if you're a commercial transmission company like Clean Line or Transwest Express or some of these others that are an individual LLC, you have certain requirements to participate also. Okay, so you can't just, I'm just an independent guy, I can go out here and do my own thing. Not anymore. Again, these commercial lines and projects have to be vetted through this FERC Order 1000 planning process, and we're calling it a regional process. The regional process compliance filings were due in October. Fully two-thirds of the transmission providers asked for extension to the end of July of this year for their regional process. Originally, the interregional, again, we're talking northwest to southwest or northwest to Colorado, those were due the 1st of April or roughly the 15th of April, somewhere in there. Those have been pushed off until the end of this year in October, November timeframe. So folks were struggling with the regional and interregional compliance filings to FERC. And it's because of this next bullet, cost allocation methodology. One of the requirements that FERC came out with in FERC Order 1000 said, in a regional transmission environment, you have to be able to identify the beneficiaries and allocate the cost roughly commensurate, and that's a great legal term. I want you folks to know that. Roughly commensurate with the benefits associated with the project. In real terms, what that roughly commensurate means is we're not going to count pennies here, folks. We're going to say if you've got some benefits and it looks like it can be quantified, we're going to kind of round it off to the nearest percentage. So you might get 10% of the benefits, you might get 15, you might get 20. We're not going to try to count dollars and try to quantify exactly what your benefits are worth in terms of the cost benefit. Not the intent of the rule at all. The intent of the rule is to try to get folks at the table to talk about cost allocation and talk about sharing of costs for these very large projects, okay? So that cost allocation methodology has been the big bugaboo for the transmission providers throughout the country to be able to make their filings for FERC Order 1000. And if they've not yet come to an agreement among themselves, FERC in their order has said you have until this deadline to file. If you can't come up with a cost allocation methodology, we will decide it for you. Well, that's got everybody nervous. So they'd rather not have the commission decide what the cost allocation should be for these large projects. And again, this goes right back to the interconnection facilities too. If it's determined that an interconnection facility has regional benefit because it's large enough, and I guess here's an example would be the Aeolus substation that's a 500 kV hub in Wyoming right now that is going to be the termination of several 500 kV lines. that may very well have regional benefits to a lot of different folks. That substation by itself is estimated to cost $50 million, okay? So just that one terminal there is going to be huge, and figuring out who's going to buy and pay for all of that equipment, that's where the rubber hits the road, and that's where the real struggle has been right here. One of the things that I should step back there, the non-incumbent provider requirements, one of the things that FERC Order 1000 said was just because this project is located in your service territory does not automatically give you the right of first refusal to build those facilities. There may be a less expensive option out there through another transmission owner or provider. So what we're finding is some of the traditional transmission utilities now are finding other joint ventures are coming into their backyard and proposing facilities. Maybe not so much here in the West, but certainly in the Southwest. Kansas, Texas, Oklahoma are all seeing major transmission lines being proposed as joint ventures between traditional utilities. And they are coming in and proposing to these folks, we can do it cheaper and we can do it faster. Therefore, give us the opportunity. Some of the independent system operators like Mid-Continent, ISO, MISO, they are actually going out for competitive bids. They're saying, okay, I've got an RFP for a 500 kV line from point A to point B. Who wants to build it? Who's going to do it cheapest? Who can do it fastest? And that kind of thing. So it's an interesting process. Compliance reports, those are almost every utility's bane, but as a renewable energy developer, you're also going to fall under the FERC requirements. You are going to have to meet the NERC reliability standards. That's the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, NERC. They have reliability standards that every project and transmission facility has to meet those. You have to file those with FERC and with NERC both to show that your project will meet all local, national, and in some cases international standards for electric utility operation. So I think I'm going to be quiet for a few minutes. We've got about 15 minutes left in the session. If there are some questions and answers,
thank you, Ed. So now we'll go ahead and get into the questions and answer session, as Ed mentioned. As I mentioned before, you can submit your questions by going to the questions pane in the box showing on your screen. So we will get to as many questions as time allows. So let's go ahead and get started. You mentioned a compliance filing that is required by FERC Order 1000. Are there other FERC filings required for a renewable energy project to move forward?
I think I mentioned the NERC standards is one. There's also other, it depends on if you are a independent developer or if you are a developer that already has projects online. I think I mentioned Iberdrola, there's others out there, Invenergy. Those other compliance filings are typically tariff filings, if you will. For one thing, we know that FERC, all hydro projects, small hydro, which in some states can be classified as renewable projects, FERC has the jurisdiction over hydroelectric licensing. I think a good example would be the 890 compliance filing demonstrating that a utility has a firewall, if you will, between their generation and or their transmission. 890 is also a kind of a catch-all where they were trying to correct some of the other deficiencies. Similarly, FERC Order 2000, they were trying to correct some of the deficiencies. A lot of these new orders now require an update to show, okay, we want you to show how you changed your tariff to accommodate our new rules. Mid-Continent ISO, I'll bet they make a FERC filing at least once a month for one aspect of their tariff or other. For example, market rate base or market based rates, if you are intending to charge your transmission service at market rates, you must go to FERC and get approval to do that. And that is, those are separate and distinct from the interconnection process and or from the tariff process. So, good question.
Okay. Looks like, let's see. During the facility study phase of development, how much room for negotiation is there for system addition?
Well, oh, that's a hard one. I guess if I was sitting in PG&E's chair, I would say there's no room at all. But if I'm a smaller utility out here in the heartland, there's probably quite a bit of negotiation available. For example, some solar developers sell packages, if you will, so that they're, you know, they have modules and things that, that basically their interconnection package is a set design, and it makes for a very nice, clean interconnection process, if you will. However, that depending on the local utilities operating or maintenance practices, they may not like seeing that equipment. That may be completely foreign to them. They say, no, I want you to use a traditional transformer breaker, you know, disconnect switch type arrangement. So I'd say there's a fair amount, but you don't want to go in to the process thinking, well, I'm going to be able to negotiate them out of a $60,000 breaker. Virtually every utility, and it's called out in the NERC reliability standards, has to have system control and disconnect of the generator, particularly if it's larger than maybe 5 megawatts. If it's larger than 20 megawatts, for sure, you have to have real-time monitoring, control, and metering of that facility. So, again, I hate to not answer the question, but I think there is a fair amount of room for negotiation, but maybe not as much as the developers would hope, if you will. So,
okay. That sounds good. I have kind of a several questions from a particular person. It says, would it be possible to briefly discuss the 1,500-foot spacing WEC has to maintain the reliability of a transmission line? Is this a requirement, and are the reasons for this written somewhere? Instead, we are hearing a 250-foot possible spacing for pinch point areas.
Yes, that's a great question. Let me start by saying that right now the ruling body, if you will, for transmission and substation design requirements is the National Electric Safety Code, okay? There are no reliability standards there that have been adopted by NERC, which is the North American Electric Reliability Corporation. And again, they are the standards body for generally in the utility business. There are no requirements for spacing called out in the NERC standards. The WEC has decided to adopt a 1,500-foot spacing because of reliability for, and when you think about the how wide open we are out here, many of these lines, if they would be on the same corridor or right-of-way, with high winds and or a failure, you could take out more than one line at a time. With a single bad ice storm, for example. That's certainly a concern, and you can alleviate that to some extent with a 1,500-foot separation. But that, to my mind, is not a hard and fast requirement. It is a WEC recommendation. And we, in fact, as HDR, a transmission line design firm, we have told our clients that here's what you have to meet is the NESC, and the 250-foot right-of-way width is an NESC requirement for a 500 kV line where the conductor is at a certain elevation or height off the ground. And the concern, and again, the right-of-way width is determined by the span length between towers, and the if you are designing criteria is 70 miles an hour. Can everybody hear me okay? I think I'm getting some feedback through my phone. Are you okay, Courtney?
I can hear you just fine.
Okay. I'm hearing just, it's kind of like what we were heard in when I was on earlier last week. So anyway, depending on how far apart the towers are, you have a sag in the conductor. And our design criteria says at 70 miles an hour, straight force wind, how far to the side will that conductor blow out, okay? And that's what we call the blowout distance. And if your span between towers is 1,200 feet and your sag is 40 feet, which is not uncommon, it would not be unreasonable to know that from the end or the tip of the conductor or the insulator out, you could be as much as 50 feet from the edge of the tower to the edge of the right-of-way. And again, that's the clearance that is spelled out in the National Electric Safety Code. If you want to put a line in or multiple lines in a 250-foot corridor, you certainly can. But you still have to maintain those blowout distances between conductors and between lines. You can get around that if you on a 250-foot corridor, for example, by putting a double-circuit tower. You could put double-circuit 500, 345, 230, almost any circuit you wanted in a 250-foot right-of-way or multiple circuits. I would not say you could do more than three, and I say that only because your tower height would be so tall that you might run into some real design issues with the foundations. So did that answer the question? I hope.
Okay. What type of emergency would a transmission company need to have making it necessary to offload the existing current from a transmission line into a ground electrode bed? And if that's ever done, is there any danger to those users in the immediate or surrounding area?
That's an interesting question. There's the reason you have the ground grids and the ground beds is to control the flow of that fault current. The question is a little bit backward. We know that oftentimes there are failures that occur and that a conductor will come in contact with a tower. That tower should be grounded to the ground through what we call a counterpoise. And again, that depending on the location, that might be just a single copper rod buried into the ground next to the foundation, you know. Or in some other areas, depending on the type of soils, they may actually at certain intervening points along the tower put down a copper mat, if you will, to spread that current out so that it will dissipate through the soils. There really is no danger to a human person other than if you were standing in contact with a tower at the point at which it was faulted, you would have some current flow through you. There's no question. But the probability and the statistics of that happening are very, very small. And for one reason, that's why you'll find for these large lattice steel towers at the base, you'll find a sign that says, caution, stay away, energized equipment. You know, I mean, it's a warning. Cows don't listen to that, though. So cows will go rub on it, and occasionally you'll find a cow that got electrocuted, and you'll wonder why. Well, it's typically probably a lightning strike nearby that grounded itself through the tower, and the cow happened to be rubbing against it at the time. So I've not heard of very many, if any, occasions where humans have been caught by that same situation. So.
Okay. This is for co-location. Can an AC line hang on the same structure as a DC line?
Yes, it can, but it would pose some pretty significant design issues or considerations. The phenomenon, one of the things that you find with DC current, and it's, again, a phenomenon that you won't, that you, well, let me back up. I'll say it the other way. AC current works and our AC grid works through the physics phenomenon known as magnetic induction. So as current flows down an AC conductor, it will induce currents in adjacent conductors. So what you, those currents, and again, you will find that through mutual inductance of the three conductors on a given tower, if that's all you have, If you have a line with a distribution underbuild, you may find induced currents from the high voltage line into the underbuild that have to be accommodated. Often these can be shielded again, and merely the distance between conductors has a huge impact of it. It changes as a function of the square of the distance. So, you know, your impacts at 2 feet are going to be, or at 4 feet are going to be a square root of what they would be at 2 feet, if you will. Similarly, at 16 feet, you're going to find a 16th of whatever that exponential is going to be. Very, very small. So as you move away from those energized AC conductors, you lose the induced AC currents. What you wouldn't want in your DC line would have induced AC currents, because that would make your DC line waveform look very nasty, and your inverter and converter would not like that on each end of the DC line. But again, if they're separated by enough distance and the voltage is appropriate for the design of the tower and the structure, yes. You can hang almost anything, any voltage levels, multiple times on a tower. What we do find, though, is because of maintenance reasons and or the criticality of circuits, you don't do that very much. You won't find in fact, to my knowledge, I've not seen an AC and a DC line on the same structure ever, and I don't know that that's ever been done, just because the phenomenon between the AC and DC currents are so different, the design considerations are different. It can be done, but it's not done as a general rule.
Okay, we have time for one last question. When considering NEPA, why wouldn't development of the wind farm be considered a connected action of the transmission line?
In a lot of cases it is. I guess I'm looking at that question the wrong way. If the transmission line is less than a certain distance, for example, here in Montana, if the connecting transmission line is less than 10 miles long, then, and it's on private property or state property, then you basically get a pass from the connected action part of it. If it's greater than 10 minutes, then, or 10 miles, then you have to do, as a minimum, our state requirements are an EA, and in most cases it would be an EIS then too. The connected action actually comes when you have a federal interaction. Ideally, a developer would choose to put his renewable project on private land. His connecting line would come into the grid across private land, and therefore he would have no connected action. Depends on the state requirements. Many of the states require a federal EIS process, just because it's a known quantity and they don't have to come up with one on their own. I don't know. I hope I answered that. That might be one that connected actions are hard for me. I do know that Western Area Power has now said if it's a renewable project that is connecting into their existing transmission system with no facility additions required, we will grant them a CX right off the bat. So that, at the feasibility level, Western Area Power has come out and said if you're a renewable energy project and you're coming into one of our substations as an existing facility with no facility additions required other than the interconnection itself, it's a CX, which is a huge change from what they had done previously, which would be evaluate everyone on a standalone basis to see. And that, again, would go clear back to the generator, the wind or the solar farm itself. So, in effect, Western was saying, we don't think we need to be doing EISs for every one of these renewable projects if they're in the same general location and they're tying into the existing system. But that may be an unusual step for a federal agency to take, too. So, hope that answered it.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Ed. So right now we'd like to thank the Bureau of Land Management and Ed Weber for their time today. The webinar files will be available at a later date on the Knowledge Resource Center hosted by BLM's National Training Center. And if you have further questions for the BLM, please contact someone on the slide showing on your screen. And so that concludes today's webinar. We'd like to thank you for participating, and goodbye.